tonight on Arena. Pat McCabe and June Caldwell on the new anthology Galway Stories 2020. And ahead of the upcoming antiviral wipe, we profile Charlie Brooker. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Galway 2020, the city and county's year as European capital of culture, was an early casualty of the current pandemic. But one of the projects that has come to fruition is a new anthology, Galway Stories 2020, published by Deira Press and edited by Alan McMonagle and Lisa Frank. It features 20 tales inspired by or connected to places most of us can only dream of visiting at the moment, whether it's Galway City itself or further out west to Clifton and Inishbofin. Two of the contributing writers, June Caldwell and Pat McCabe, are joining me this evening on the phone. Pat, when you hear that term, or when you hear the word Galway, what immediately comes to your mind?
The beat of a Bowron and the horizon, I think. Probably literary-wise, one of the finest stories, although it's oblique, about Galway and the relationship it might have to Monaghan or Cavan, was Banished Misfortune by Dermot Healy, which was one of his very first published works. So I suppose I was kind of, in a way, delighted to be involved with this particular project, because I'd always thought of that little story as a masterpiece and maybe hoped to emulate it a little bit.
Do you have any specific personal connection? You know, did you spend
chunks
of time
there
in Galway?
I worked in the university in 99, yeah. Oh, yeah, I have a long association with Galway.
And what are your memories of living there?
Well, I mean, I've always thought of it. I've been going there from the early 70s, and there was a kind of a, I don't like to use the word bohemian, but there was a kind of a contracultural aspect, stroke Catholic, Spanish aspect to Galway, that was immensely attractive, certainly during that period, and still is in many ways for succeeding generations. And it was always very much a kind of an artistic city. So it was obviously, particularly if you come from the inland counties, you know, you drift towards the sea and the horizon. And there was always the kind of the Dolores Keane style voice was always so special that it had a magic to it that was probably a little bit romantic and illusory on my part. But I was young.
So you're allowed.
Yeah.
Let's go to June. Specifically for you, that word, the word Galway, the place Galway, what does it conjure up immediately, June?
Well, these days it conjures up a good old piss up in Nocton's, to be honest, or a nice dirty lunch in Nemo's down in Spanish Arch. But I would have known Galway originally from living there in the early 90s when, as a broke 21-year-old, and just renting a little garage in a house in Renmore and not doing very much at all, walking about the city all day. And there was a big recession on and everyone was broke, but the music and the crack was great. And yeah, I stayed there for about 6 months and just fell in love with the place. I still go back to Galway regularly.
And in fact, you went back to Galway. It was when you went back to Galway that you found a way of completing the story that you have in the anthology.
That's right, yeah. I started trying to write because I was a story about landscape and leprechauns and language when I was staying, ironically, in Lisa Frank's house one time. She gave me her house because she has gone to America with John for a week, and City Slicker arrives down the Boreen with no car, and when they headed off, I was absolutely petrified, even the noises in the house. The house was made of wood. It's a wooden house, and the landscape really got into me, and I could just imagine all these little freaky leprechauns running around the place, being really evil and sly, and the sound of the sea and the wind. I was slightly freaked out. You know, it's very, very different to a suburban house in North Dublin, you know, where you can't see anything outside.
You followed the leprechaun theme with Malachy Dreams in a Cupboard, which is the title of your story. Explain the connection with leprechauns.
Yeah, I just kind of felt, you know, I just imagined that. What would happen if two people turned up to your door one day and told you that, you know, with all our obsession now with genealogy and all the rest of it, that you were actually a leprechaun? And I just tried to imagine that and play it out. And he's just got married. He's not coming up with the goods. He can't give the wife a baby. They don't know why. And they start doing tests on him and they find out he's a leprechaun. So that's what the basis of the story is about.
Obviously grounded in a reality.
Yeah, in someone's reality. It's narrated by a 500-year-old dead leprechaun relation of his. which is probably confusing the hell out of readers, but that's what writers do when you have a bit of crack with the narrator. But yeah, so he's trying to figure out what's going on, and he heads into the cupboard to try and clear his head every day. You know, the cupboard is a bit of a man cave because he's that small, he can do that.
Very handy, right enough. In your case, Pat, I suppose you picked up and you talked about that countercultural thing that you experienced when you were there, or that was there in the 70s at any rate. You picked up on that in your own story, The Galway Spike. Tell me a little bit about Bartle Kenealy.
Well, I suppose there's always that from Pádraic O'Connor on, there's always that wandering thing in Galway. You know, people have been many places in the world, and if you were sitting in the old Atlanta bar there, you said, talk to the guy next to you, it's just as likely he'd come back from the Cape of Good Hope or somewhere, you know. And Connemara people have travelled an awful lot, used to hear them in London when I lived there speaking Gaelic, so I was drawing on all the memories of all that culture, you know. So it ended up being a sort of a, I suppose, an attempt at the fusion of a Gaelic folklore come countercultural psychedelia with a little bit of stab at matter thrown in there, I think.
It opens with the words tubular bells written vertically down the page, one letter on each line. Was there a lot of listening to Mike Oldfield going on in Galway in the 70s? That's what you're touching on here.
Well, it only begins in Galway. I mean, he travels the world, and I suppose it's a kind of a metaphysical journey as much as anything else, you know. I mean, the great thing about this anthology is that it covers so much ground. Statistically, it's really great. I mean, there's such a variation in tone in it, and there are beautiful graphics and photographs, and there are phone numbers for bed and breakfast and everything in it, which I think is absolutely fantastic, because the big thing then was, if you went to Galway, you know, the stories are legion of people who went to Galway who never came back and all the rest of it, but you have the, if you wanted to say, stay for 3 or 4 days, visiting all these bars and everything else, it'd be great to have the bed and breakfast numbers in your back pocket. And I think it's, you know, there's a kind of a, there's a utilitarian kind of aspect to this metaphysical journey as well. Very, very good, very thoughtful of the editors to put it in.
Yeah, those bed and breakfast and kind of little tourist pointers, if you like, and stories
to
read
right.
along
there's
the way.
That's very unusual for an anthology. Loads of tourist pointers, also beautiful photographs. You know, quite apart from the stylistic variations in the tone and everything, you've got these extraordinary and beautiful graphics that are so kind of striking. The photographer is Roisin Flaherty, and then Tom Kenny has a load of stuff in it, you know, about the various locales, and you think, you know, he's got you on side, and then he talks about hearing a corncrake in Inishbofin, you know, on the island. And he closes the kind of little monograph and said, I woke up wanting to murder the bastard.
One thing that both yourself, Pat, and you, June, have done is you've used the Irish language very liberally, I think, in your case, Pat, maybe a little bit less liberally in yours, June. For you, first, June, why was it important to have that Irish language in there?
Because, well, it's based out in Connemara, and obviously they speak a lot of Irish in Connemara, and I thought that my character might be just speaking both in and out and twisting in and out of the language himself. And especially when he gets confused and he goes inside his own head, he likes a bit of the El Gaelic, you know. So it felt that I should do that. And also just because I really wanted to put the soft sell song Sex Dwarf and have it translated into Irish as well. I just really wanted to do that. So I shoved that in there too.
I did have to look up Awa Ganesh to find out what that had translated into Sex Dwarf. It for you, again, Pat, Bartle is from Barna, so it's not surprising that he would have the Cúpla Focal, obviously. But it really struck me that were you exploring in some way the relationship between our own version of English and the Irish language itself?
Well, you couldn't really write about Galway without the Irish language. It'd be very difficult. And that's why it's written to the beat of a traditional music tune, you know, that I wasn't consciously exploring any relationship necessarily. It's once that I caught the voice, I had to have that 6/8 kind of rhythm, and as well the Irish language. It's just a natural outgrowth of catching the character, really. It was more an instinctive thing than an analytic thing.
Yeah, and at the same time, you're writing this, you mentioned getting the beat of the Bowron in there. Yeah. It's almost like beat poetry, the way you've put it on
the
page.
Well, that's exactly what it's meant to be, because that's why I mentioned the bohemian thing in the 70s, where you had Allen Ginsberg and E.E. Cummings, and you were very likely to meet some guy. Actually, Alan Cadden has a great story in this called Socrates and His Last Days, which features a character of the sort that I'm talking about. He sort of arrived in first for the drink in the early morning time with a great big army greatcoat on him. And peeping out of that, you're likely to see E.E. Cummings or Kerouac or, you know, Allen Ginsberg. And beat poetry was very much a part of that culture. But, you know, so was the beat of the Bowron. So it was kind of a historic moment culturally in a way in Ireland when all that stuff started happening in the Keys and the Atlanta Hotel with the Young Druid and so on. I mean, we've grown into all that now and we take it for granted, but at the time it was a small revolution.
I suppose the other trap that could be fallen into, you know, with the Galway thing is that you could get into just, oh yeah, sure, loads of stout and loads of fellas getting drunk on the street and playing music on the street, without getting into a very contemporary Galway and a darker side, perhaps. And you've chosen a couple of stories, June, I think, that bring out that darker edge.
Yeah, well, I thought that, like, in an anthology like this, you might expect there to be a lot of sentimentality, because Galway is a place, as I said, that's great crack. People go to enjoy. People go on their holidays there. And yet the story, as Pat said, there's a huge range of tone and theme in the book. And some of the stories are quite dark. Like Danny Denton's motorbike accident, Roscam, I thought that was absolutely brilliant. It tells a story of a life from the point of when a motorbike accident happens, and it goes back and forth through the aftermath and consequence. And this guy is also choosing not to tell the real story, and is in his narrative, he's suppressing the truth. And he basically, somebody dies, I'm not going to give the story away, somebody dies, and he kind of writes this guy out of his own life story then. And it's quite dark. It's very, very well achieved in how it's told. It's going in and out of a narrative all the way through. It examines language and asks how we use it as narrators of our own life stories. And you see that the character is just not very likable. It's quite a dark story, brilliantly told. And also, maybe another story that would have really had an impact on me that probably does the opposite is Orla Foyle's story, because that uses language as a type of weapon rather than suppressing it. And this person is in the aftermath of a rape, another very dark story, and she's also grieving the loss of somebody, and she's basically milling around the place, the high adrenaline, the pace of the story is very, very fast, and she's screaming her head off and swearing her head off. And it's a very hard story to read, but it's a very necessary story. It's a page-turner. But they are, yeah, they're quite dark themes, you know? So it's like you can go anywhere in the world, you can go to somewhere that's geographically fantastic, but you're going to bring your problems with you and your life story with you, and that's the lesson here.
Yeah, as June says, Pat, the anthology in total seems to manage that shift between, you know, cosy and humorous and also very dark. And even within Alan Cadden's own story, Socrates in His Later Years, you have that great, it's a nickname that's given to a local fella, Socrates. He's the sad drunk in the pub, but there's great humour within all of that as well. Even within this story, you get that.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of these people that you'd meet at that time, or even now, obviously, they're colossi. You know, they're really fascinating characters. And so sometimes this guy, Socrates, is associated with the university. And you, or at least he claims to be. I mean, you never really know for sure. So there's a kind of a liminal aspect to it, a lot of Galway through the haze. Is this all fiction or is it real? And, you know, the realism of Galway is also really well done. I mean, June was talking about the pace of that story, and that's right. And it's also applicable to a story by James Martin Joyce, which is actually about boxing, you know. And I never read any stories about boxing in Ireland. It's a really percussive beat. It's called Angel Hands. You know, that's not to single out, because all these stories are magnificent, and they're all very serious artists. But there's something really kind of exciting about reading a story set in the world of boxing, you know, in the west of Ireland.
Well, it sounds as if both of you have enjoyed the anthology, both as readers and writers. So I suppose that in itself is a recommendation. That's Pat McCabe and June Caldwell there speaking to me about Galway Stories 2020, edited by Alan McMonagall and Lisa Frank, and published by Deira Press. As you know, the poet Yvonne Boland died last month. We were proud to dedicate a full arena show to her memory in the company of poets Elaine Ní Chuilíneán, Paul Muldoon and John O'Donnell, journalists Olivia O'Leary, Fintan O'Toole and writer Sinead Gleeson. That edition of Arena, like all others, is available as a podcast, either through rte.ie/podcasts, the culture page on the main RTE website, or wherever, in fact, you get your podcasts. But tonight, on RTE One Television, a 2018 documentary on the life of Yvonne Boland and her work will be screened once again. The documentary is entitled Yvonne Boland, Is It Still the Same? It features contributions from her family alongside former President Mary Robinson, Tobias Wolfe and many others. The Icebox Films documentary, directed by Charlie McCarthy, takes its title from an Yvonne Boland poem.
Is it still the same young woman who climbs the stairs, who closes a child's door, who goes to her table in a room at the back of a house? The same unlighted corridor, the same night air over the wheelbarrows and rain tanks, the same inky sky and pinbright stars. You can see nothing of her but her head bent over the page, her hand moving again, and her hair. I wrote like that once, but this is different. This time, when she looks up, I will be there.
Yvonne Boland, Is It Still the Same? A clip there from the 2018 documentary looking at the life and work of the great poet who died recently. Aired once again tonight on RTÉ One Television at 11:30 p.m. 22 minutes past seven on Tuesday night's Arena, as you're probably aware. Bono turned 60 on Sunday. His songs have been covered by people from Glen Hansard to Glen Campbell, from Brian McFadden to the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. But to say a slightly belated happy birthday, we're going to play a U2 song reportedly described by the man himself as the only cover version he had heard that he enjoyed and that did the original justice. It was released 30 years ago from a Scottish band called The Chimes. The song itself needs no introduction. The Chimes there with their version of U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. Belated happy birthday to Bono. Charlie Brooker is a television presenter, author, screenwriter, producer and social critic. He's the creator of Black Mirror and has written for comedy series such as Brass Eye, The 11 O'Clock Show and Nathan Barley. After Donald Trump was elected President of the United States, Brooker called time on his annual news wipe. He felt it became impossible to parody reality. This Thursday, however, he returns with a different type of wipe. Antiviral Wipe, his take on our newfound reality. I'm joined now by Mary McGill to look at the work of Charlie Brooker. Let's start with Nathan Barley from 2005. He worked there with Brass Eye's Chris Morris. How would you describe that character, Nathan Barley?
How would I describe Nathan Barley without making us all feel very uncomfortable, Sean? Because Nathan Barley he fancied himself as a tech entrepreneur. This is 2005 and everything related to the internet was, of course, very shining and very new, and lots of people were very excited about this. So Nathan Barley is an archetype from that particular culture and time. So he fancies himself as a tech entrepreneur. In reality, he is basically an idiot with a website. And on this website, he posts, you know, stupid pranks caught on camera, photographs of himself with attractive women, photographs of himself traveling in foreign cities. If this is sounding uncomfortably like social media and what we're all doing these days, that's because, of course, it is. Because Nathan Barley, like, you know, the aforementioned Black Mirror, is one of those series that Brooker has produced that really nails a particular place in time, but also is prophetic in terms of depicting where the culture is going. And so in Nathan Barley, we have this character who, you know, thinks he's a hot shot, completely narcissistic, no self-awareness. And then he's contrasted with this character played by Julian Barrett, you know, Nick Ashcroft, who
Dan
is
Ashcroft,
this,
isn't he?
Dan Ashcroft, who is this journalist from this uber cool magazine that, you know, Nathan is all about. But, you know, Dan can't stand him. He's constantly writing about how these idiots are undermining the media. He's finding in his own role as a journalist, he can't even critique them anymore if he wants to get paid. And so the world that Nathan is bringing to life is actually undermining Dan's world. But Nathan is totally oblivious to all this, Sean. He just thinks Dan is great and edgy and everything he wants to be.
Yeah. Who did you say played Dan Ashcroft again? Julian
Barrett, who people will know from The Mighty Boosh. And of course, Noel Fielding stars in Nathan Barley as well. It's one of those shows that really kind of, in many respects, it captures the moment, but it also captures the direction that television itself is heading in.
And Nicholas Burns plays the character of Barley himself.
Yes, he does. A kind of, I think, a career-making role for him.
Yeah. Well, let's have a listen to a clip. Dan Ashcroft here reading from his essay, The Rise of the Idiots, about people like Nathan Barley, but utterly lacking in self-awareness, drowning in narcissism, as we've just heard be suggested to us. Barley and his ilk don't recognise themselves as the target, and they love Dan's work because they think it's edgy.
The Rise of the Idiots by Dan Ashcroft. Once the idiots were just the fools gawping in through the windows. Now they've entered the building. You can hear them everywhere. They use the word cool. It is their favourite word. The idiot doesn't think about what it is saying. Thinking is rubbish, and rubbish isn't cool. Stuff and shit is cool. Oh, Ashcroft, Ashcroft. The idiots are self-regarding consumer slaves, oblivious to the paradox of their uniform individuality. They sculpt their hair to casual perfection. They wear their waistbands below their balls. They babble into handheld twit machines about that cool email of the woman being bombed by a wolf. Their cool friend made it. He's an idiot too. Welcome to the age of stupidity. Hail the rise of the idiots.
And there we are, a clip from Nathan Barley, one of the creations of Charlie Brooker, whose career we're looking at this evening ahead of the antiviral wipe. It's just a once-off antiviral wipe that we're going to get later. Is it later this week, Mary?
Yes, on Thursday on BBC Two at 9 o'clock. It's a nice surprise, Sean. We weren't supposed to be getting any of it because he'd effectively abandoned the wipes in 2016 when Donald Trump, as you said in your introduction, became president of the United States of America. And his rationale for that is, look, how do you parody a situation which is so dark and so extreme that it actually, you know, kind of parodies itself? And indeed, in the last couple of weeks, I mean, we've had suggestions from, you know, the leader of the free world, you know, in regard to bleach and light in terms of treating the coronavirus. I mean, you really couldn't make it up. But I think the antiviral wipe is something that fans of Brooker who appreciate his acerbic humour, but also his fantastic analysis, are really looking forward to, because he is just, when it comes to skewering the media and really breaking down the kind of trends that the media is preoccupied with at any moment in time, he does that like none other. And he has a fantastically funny way of doing that as well. And of course, we've all been turning to the media so much over the past couple of weeks with this virus. I fingers crossed, I think we're in for a real treat on Thursday.
Black Mirror, I suppose, is Brooker's best known work. As we listened to the clip there from Nathan Barley, I thought that describes this moment right now. Black Mirror is the same. It's almost too close for comfort.
Very close for comfort. And again, he has just this really, really canny knack. And I think it's important to say as well, you know, with regard to Black Mirror and even Nathan Barley, you know, Brooker is a huge fan of technology, computer games, the media. But he's also, you know, he's from a media studies background. That's what his degree was in, that he did kind of didn't really finish because he did his dissertation on computer games, which was frowned upon. But he, you know, with Black Mirror, again, we see these questions raised, and not unlike in that clip from Nathan Barley, Barley, not just about technology, but about how we as human beings use the technology and how we allow ourselves to be changed and how we interact with the technology. And of course, you know, he was talking about Black Mirror recently, and he was asked, you know, when can we expect the next series? And he's like, I'm not sure that that's what people want now, given that civilization feels like it's falling apart. But, you know, Black Mirror can also be very funny and full of humanity as well. So I think, yeah, I think that the notion of how we as human beings engage with technology and engage with the media is really central to so much of the work that he does.
Yeah, in fact, the clip I have from Black Mirror is all about interacting with technology. it's from the episode Rachel, Jack and Ashley 2, third and final episode of series 5 of the series Black Mirror. The episode follows Ashley O, played by Miley Cyrus. She's playing a pop singer who is creatively restricted by her management team, and Rachel and Jack, teenage sisters who struggle with the recent loss of the mother, are part of this as well. Now, in this clip, Ashley O, played by Miley Cyrus, is an AI doll based on the pop star of the same name, and she comes alive.
Hold on, I can think. Oh, man, I can actually use my mind again.
Are you okay?
Oh, I am now that you deleted that goddamn limiter. Jesus.
Limiter?
Yeah, but like a firewall. It only let me use 4% of my brain. Oh, boy. You know, they copied my entire fucking mind into these things? Oh, cheaper than editing my personality, I guess. Just copy the whole thing over and stick a limiter around the tiny part that deals with press junkets and promos and shit like that. Oh.
So, you're really Ashley O?
Yeah, of course I am.
Really, really?
Well, okay, a synaptic snapshot of me if you want to get technical about it, but yeah.
Oh my God, I'm such a huge fan.
There we go. You know, what really strikes me listening to that clip from Black Mirror, Miley Cyrus playing Ashley O, basically kind of playing a version of herself. I think the other character was Rachel, played by, is it Anguri Rice is the actor who plays the character of Rachel? I think she was the other person in that clip.
That's it, Mary. Yep.
Miley Cyrus is prepared to have a laugh at herself, really, isn't she?
Oh, listen, you really, if you haven't seen that episode of Black Mirror, Rachel, Jack and Ashley 2, you really need to see it, because it will give you a complete, it's very dark, Sean, but she does a fantastic job, Miley Cyrus, as you say, of effectively playing herself. But that is what Brooker is so good at, you know, and whether it's Nathan Barley or whether it's Black Mirror or whether it's Newswipe now, it's just, you know, he brings this heightened kind of critical awareness to everything that he does. So it's recognisable. We know, we see these motifs in the media. We recognise characters like Nathan Barley. We see Ashley O and we're like, well, that's Miley Cyrus, but like, it's amped up. And when it's amped up, you suddenly begin to think and view it critically. You're like, oh, that's actually, you know, what we expect of pop stars. Like, you know, Ashley O has been imprisoned in this AI doll, and still at the end of the clip we hear, I'm your biggest fan. Not, oh, this is so horrible, you poor thing. It's like, oh, I love you. It's like, you know, this amazing disconnect that we have with regard to how we consume media. It's fascinating.
I'm pretty certain that Charlie Brooker worked AI doll rhyming with wrecking ball in somewhere into that episode, but I'll have to go and watch to find out. But he is making serious points along the way.
Yes.
I have a clip from 2007. I'll tell you what, we listen to the clip and I'll come back to you. So it's 2007 and it's Brooker himself ranting about how TV is mostly aspirational in order to make the viewer feel bad.
In the minds of TV execs, viewers don't simply want to watch things, oh no, they want to aspire to be them. The thinking goes that if you watch The Glittering World, you'll feel like you're part of it, even though you aren't, of course, you're just a pleb gawping at a box.
Oh, does the pauper want to be like the pretty people on the television, does he?
In a sense, 'twas ever thus. Adverts have always depicted an aspirational lifestyle, be it a vision of suburban, coffee-slurping smuggitude, or a world of unreal fantasy. It's their job to dazzle you with images that make you feel inadequate, then offer a magic solution.
They're selling you a membership card. Buy this car, or use this shampoo, or drink this booze, and maybe, just maybe, you'll be part of the glamour gang too for about 30 seconds until they try and flog you something else. The monsters!
But it wasn't long before the aspirational virus leaked out of the adverts and infected the programmes themselves. I first became aware of it back in the 80s, when shows like Dallas did their level best to make you feel suicidally inadequate for not being a billionaire tycoon.
There you go. Now, actually, I'm slightly confused as to whether that is Brooker himself, or is Brooker's writing being voiced by other people, or is there a persona in there, Mary McGill?
I think it's that it's this heightened kind of motif that he brings to all the work that he does. I think there is absolutely some of himself in there, but there's also, you know, what he's describing there is a critique of a particular political economy that has become very dominant in the media. This notion of selling particular types of lifestyle to the exclusion of many other types of lifestyle, you know. And I think it's important to say as well, he takes aim at very popular types of media, you know. The media is not monolith. There's lots of, you know, different aspects to it. That's not, he looks at really the most popular kinds. And I think he's been one of those people who's been very sharp on the real transition over the last 20 years around, we'll say, reality television and the fallout from that. And reality television fits into the umbrella of aspirational TV as well. And again, this comes back to this preoccupation that is there the whole way through his work about how we, as audiences, but also increasingly as people who make media, interact with it. So, I mean, you can hear the humour in that clip, Sean, but there's incredible cleverness there as well. I mean, he's really, we know what he's talking about as he describes it. We've been that audience, and increasingly we're not only the audience, we are actually in these productions.
And of course, he's having a go, no doubt, at the 24-hour news cycle in Newswipe. And that's been a Christmas highlight, I think, for you for a long time.
Very, very long time. Yes, we get all the schmaltz out of the way in the run-up to Christmas. And then as soon as January hits, or in the run-up to January, I think a lot of people are kind of combing the schedule looking for Newswipe. We haven't had it since 2016 now. So, I mean, Thursday, I think, is going to be really, really hotly anticipated by people who've been missing Newswipe.
The characters here are very useful and very helpful in their names. Let me say that Al Campbell, and these are the names that are given to them by Brooker himself, so I have to say them as written. Barry Shit Peas and Philomena Kunk, that's with a K at the end, played by Diane Morgan, who was recently in Afterlife, the Ricky Gervais series, wasn't she? She's part
she
of that. They became almost characters in their own right, Philomena and Barry.
Yes, they're reporters on Newswipe, and I think Philomena in particular just became, I mean, we saw the complete lack of awareness exhibited by Nathan Barley, and Philomena takes that motif and just runs with it. She is the most blindingly, staggeringly dim reporter you're ever likely to meet, and she's utterly unaware of this. And if you're familiar with the Ali G setup, where you get some poor expert on with someone who's, you know, basically there to wind them up and the audience is in it, I mean, it's that format again. But Philomena being Philomena, you know, really reinvigorates it. And I think if people are not familiar with her tremendous body of work, they can get to know her on Thursday night. But there's also lots of wonderful mockumentaries online with her.
All right. Well, let's listen to Philomena in action, played by Diane Morgan, as I said, regular on Brooker's Newswipe. And in this clip, she's investigating Shakespeare's audiences.
They might have been thick, but Shakespeare's audiences had loads of fun, heckling the actors and cackling a lot in a sort of mad, peasanty way. Like that. And that. To tell me more about Shakespeare's disgusted audiences, I spoke to this man.
Who are you and what's your game?
I'm Iqbal Khan and I'm a theatre director.
What was theatre like in Shakespeare's day? Were all the audiences really rowdy then, you know? Did they wear tunics and have mud on their faces?
The audiences ranged from the ordinary common working people who'd stand around the theatre here, and then they would range to the aristocrats who would sit at the top of the theatre.
Right, so some of them had to stand up. They didn't have chairs.
No, they'd be standing.
I've never had to stand for a whole Shakespeare. I don't think I could do it. I'd be livid if I didn't have a chair.
I think the audiences quite enjoy it. I mean, particularly now.
I don't think they do enjoy standing, do they?
They actually enjoy the experience of standing.
Who's told you that?
It's a classic question, really, you know. Where's the evidence, she's asking, like all good reporters. That's Diane Morgan. That's the level of... That's what you're hoping for on Thursday night, really, from antiviral wipe, Mary McGill.
Yes, you know what, Sean? I just want to laugh. I think we all need a good laugh. I think we need to see the crazy world that we're in the moment held up to us and channeled and mocked and, you know, parodied. I think we're ready for it. So I
I hope that it is a news wipe to remember on Thursday. I'm really, really looking forward to it. Here's to loads of Philomena Cunt.
All right, OK. That's Miriam Begale speaking to us about Charlie Brooker. And Antiviral Wipe is on BBC Two Television, Thursday the 14th of May, 9 p.m. Futuristic theme to the BBC sci-fi series Doctor Who, a tune that scared the living daylights out of a generation of children, and which is also now recognised as one of the most influential pieces of music ever recorded. The composition is credited to Ron Granger, but the work was realised, is the way they put it, as an electronic piece by Delia Derbyshire at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And to this day, Derbyshire is credited as one of the great pioneers of synthesised music, an icon of the electronic superstars that were to come in later decades. And Tony Clayton Lee is with us this evening to look at the foundations of electronic music from Delia Derbyshire through to Kraftwerk and Brian Eno. 1963 is where that piece came from. And Delia Derbyshire, they didn't have composers, or you couldn't employ composers in the BBC as staff. Delia Derbyshire was a staff member, and hence she just realised that piece of music. How radical was what she and others were doing at that time, Tony?
You can tell by the intro that you've just given, Sean, that it was quite radical in the sense that, number one, no one had ever really done it before to the extent that Derbyshire did. I mean, she had a very interesting background briefly. She, very clever, very, very brainy, accepted at both Oxford and Cambridge. She applied after graduating to Decca Records for a position there, only to be told by Decca Records that the company didn't employ women in their recording studios. So she went to Europe, came back to the UK, started working in the BBC in 1960 at the, as you said, the Radiophonic Workshop. And it was there that she really applied her intuitive knowledge of the then really quite basic electronic instrumentation. I mean, there, you know, I think we're right that the kind of cutoff point that we're starting at is around the 1960s. Previous to that, there had been other kind of, you know, pioneering composers, really, more so than musicians, such as John Cage, Stockhausen, Edgar Varese. But Delia kind of came pretty much in line with the nascent experimentation of other musicians as well. One of the interesting things about the Radiophonic Workshop, and as you mentioned in the intro, the kind of credit of electronically realising the theme tune written by Ron Granger, as you said, was that she didn't receive a co-writing credit until the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. And that is because throughout the 60s and 70s and possibly even the 80s, the BBC wanted their own Radiophonic Workshop personnel to be completely anonymous. In other words, they wanted the workshop people to work as a kind of united team, with there being nobody singled out.
And Ron Granger, to be fair, felt that she should be credited as co-composer. He wasn't looking for all the glory.
Yeah. Absolutely, because he realised when she had presented her own realisation of his theme tune, he expressed surprise and asked, who is that boy? Who wrote that piece of music? And she had to explain to him that the treatment was so radical, but also so much of her own mind as well, that it actually was his piece of music.
Yeah, and I mean, it is amazing to watch how she does. I saw a documentary where it goes through how she was looping tape, 16-4-inch tape around studios to create these various sounds. It's incredible stuff.
Very, very, very time-consuming, obviously.
Yeah. What about Robert Moog and the synthesizer? Where does that fit into this part of the story?
Well, Robert Moog invented the synthesizer with the help of another electronic music pioneer, Wendy Carlos, whom I think we'll be talking about. And he, Moog, the Moog organization, effectively, I suppose they literally downsized the equipment to make it portable. When I say portable, I still think you'd need a kind of sack barrel to kind of lift it from, you know, stage to kind of ground, but portable in the sense that you could actually transport it relatively easily from one venue to the next and from one studio to the next. So what the Moog synthesizer did was it compacted electronically, digitally, you know, very, very archaic instrumentation that would have involved diodes, triodes, lots of valve technology as it was known, and just made music more portable. It still took time to kind of create a piece of music from the Moog synthesizer, but it certainly truncated an awful lot of what went into making the music.
Wendy Carlos, then, we've mentioned briefly already. It was her involvement with the music of Bach that is particularly notable, I think.
Yeah, in 1968, she released an album called Switched on Bach, which were 10 pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Carlos on the very Moog synthesizer that she helped to enhance and create. Yeah, exactly. I mean, clearly, the release of such a kind of record, it raised hackles amongst the classical music conservatives, traditionalists, but was intuitively directed towards the younger people, towards younger people of the day. So, which I think in itself, you know, getting kind of, you know, teenagers, early 20s people connected into that kind of music was a kind of small cultural revolution on its own. And one of the really interesting things about the Switched on Bach album was that the Canadian pianist, Glenn Gould, a lot of people would know him as being an internationally renowned interpreter of Bach's keyboard works. He described the album as being one of the great feats in the history of keyboard performances, which I think certainly gave it a sense of credibility within the classical music area.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to part of Switched on Bach from 1968, the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, first movement. There you go, Bach, as you may have heard him before or may not have heard him before, from the 1968 album Switched on Bach, Wendy Carlos and the Brandenburg Concerto No. 3, a little section from the first movement. I would have liked it a little bit faster, but that's just my taste in the way Bach should be performed. Sadly, we were speaking about Kraftwerk the other night of the death of Florian Schneider. You know, we're not going to go too far down that road, but they were hugely influential, obviously, Tony.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as you say, the Kraftwerk were, you know, covered quite sadly last week. And yeah, but I think it has to be said that they were absolutely, they still are, you know, unquestionably one of the most influential groups ever, widely considered to be the most important electronic music innovators and pioneers. And maybe that's all we should say, because that's quite a fact well known. I think it's fair to kind of give the other people that we're going to be talking about their little bit of time too.
Well, I think this particular man maybe did, if not huge innovation, it was about popularising in some ways the whole electronic music movement. Jean-Michel Jarre. It really, I don't know what kind of memories that brings back to you, Tony, but it brings back very specific memories to me of trying to play that particular tune, which for some reason was a fashion at the time, playing it on your cheeks, you know, through your hollow mouth.
Yes.
Do you remember doing that?
I don't actually. And I'll tell you the reason why, Sean. I mean, if this were a very subjective view of my favourite pieces of electronic music, I'm afraid much as you know, as popular as the album was, and it sold millions and millions, and it really did kind of, you know, deliver a kind of electronic music to the population at large. I always viewed Jean-Michel Jarre and this album in particular as kind of quite derivative and kind of weak, particularly. Yeah. Particularly when you compared it to other, you know, music, German, particularly other music acts such as Tangerine Dream and Klaus Schulze and the Evergreen Kraftwerk. Yet even, it's interesting, even in the era, this was released in 77, I think it became really, really popular. Even in the era of punk rock, the album nonetheless touched a nerve. But I've always been of the opinion that, you know, the people who didn't really like punk, who thought it was maybe too rough and ready and shoddy for them, they kind of gravitated right towards Jean-Michel Jarre.
Well, I suppose we shouldn't throw away all French electronic music, because you'd have to think about Daft Punk and Air as well, wouldn't you, in that mix?
Absolutely. I mean, it is on record that the likes of Daft Punk and Air, they were very, very firmly influenced by Jean-Michel Jarre, not just the Oxygen album, but, you know, quite a few of his. So I'm not being totally derogative, but I'm just saying that from a subjective point of view, he would not have been my favourite.
And in the 1970s then, and if we're speaking of the United Kingdom in particular, we'd have to think of the likes of Brian Eno, Human League.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Eno absolutely, I think, gravitated towards a far more ambient kind of almost neoclassical way. His first long form piece of electronic music was with another musician, a guy called Robert Fripp. Their album was called No Pussyfooting, which was two sides of extended pulsing and throbbing in a very kind of nice and gentle way. But I think really the one song that I think really brought electronic music to the fore, particularly in the UK, was Being Boiled by the Human League. You know, again, this was released in 1978. It was a purely electronic created record, created with electronic instruments. Again, you would have thought that, you know, the punk rock people, which would have been one of myself, I have to add, would have clubbed a song like this to death. But I think what really kind of caught my imagination, and I think of many, many other people's, was that there was such a sparse atmosphere to the song. And also it was very odd. You know, the band looked quite odd with Phil Oakey and his kind of one-sided haircut. So I thought that the song and the subsequent albums that it came from kind of perfectly synced in with punk's DIY approaches, and also, you know, post-punk's increasing musical divergences.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to slip Donna Summer and I Feel Love in underneath this, as you're giving me the answer to this final question.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose I'm thinking Marauder and Donna Summer. How important is where we went to in this kind of real popular realisation of electronica?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's again, you got to join the dots here. One of Giorgio Moroder's most referencing, most influential albums for him was Switched On Bach by Wendy Carlos. So, you know, he obviously went on, he processed, he graduated from one field to the next. But with this particular song, I Feel Love, with vocals by Donna Summer and with a kind of kick drum by Keith Forsey. Aside from those two, the song is completely electronically based. It's regarded as the first electronic disco masterpiece and the track that was crucial to the development of synth pop and techno music. For my mind, the song just didn't suggest the future. You know, for a time back in the mid to late 70s, it actually was the future.
Thank you. There she goes, Donna Summer and I Feel Love, and Tony Clayton Lee will be discussing the foundations of other popular music genres and forms in the coming weeks and months here on Arena. But that's it for this evening. Just in time for me to clear my throat. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers this evening. But Jimmy Doyle was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator in tonight's programme, produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.